America's historically racialized housing policies created a legacy that is still with us today. St. Louis is a prime example of how redlining and urban renewal contributed to deep disparities in economic opportunity, school performance, and police presence. There are loads of statistics that can prove the point, but giving the numbers a human voice makes the case more compelling. A new multimedia exhibit at UNC Chapel Hill tries to do just that. In the Shadows of Ferguson opens this Sunday afternoon at Davis Library in Chapel Hill. And joining me now is the lead researcher for the exhibit, Mai Nguyen. She's a professor of city and regional planning at UNC Chapel Hill, and she joins us now. Welcome back. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Frank.
Also,
glad to be here.
Also with us is Maggie West, co-founder and former co-director for the Community Empowerment Fund. Welcome, Maggie.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Mai, let's talk about the exhibit that you put together and the genesis of it. And you picked St. Louis. So what was it about St. Louis that attracted you in the first place?
Yeah, St. Louis is such an interesting city. It actually has some landmark civil rights cases that have shaped housing policy all over the United States. And once I started digging into that and talking to people in St. Louis, the stories, the actors are still there in St. Louis. So I could actually talk to the Green versus McDonnell Douglas case, right? Percy Green is still active in St. Louis. And so these activists and local actors were still there. And so it's just an interesting story to look at the disinvestment of cities and the segregation and how it's continued to really create this out migration of residents from the city of St. Louis.
Well, tell us about those cases.
Yeah, so one of the key landmark cases is about racially restrictive covenants, the Shelley versus Kramer case. J.D. Shelley and his wife were sued by the Homeowners Association because they purchased a home with a restrictive covenant. And this case went all the way to the Supreme Court.
They were black, obviously. The restrictive covenant would not have permitted them to be in there.
Exactly.
And just to go back, because people may not be aware of this, and they may not have been aware of the number of deeds they signed and mortgages they signed that had these, but they're rules, essentially. So while the law may not permit discrimination and segregation, you may have a rule that says you may not sell this to a black person or a person of color, and it's in the paperwork that you sign when you buy a house.
Right. It's a private agreement between the buyer and seller. It's in the deed, actually, that restricts the sale of a house to a minority household. And in the 1930s and 40s, those were typically African American or Jewish households.
Yeah. So these things, and they went untested. So while segregation might have been illegal in the North, it was perfectly legal, and it was happening all the time through these covenants.
That's right. They were not contested in the courts yet, right. So they were effectively legal.
And so talk about this case, which was an important case, but the fact is the damage had been done. Neighborhoods had gone for at least a generation or two that had gone, remained segregated.
Right. So we've created these cities that were segregated. But even after this ruling, these deeds, as you mentioned, continue to be on the sale of homes. And so this practice continued, even though there was this case, really until the 1968 Fair Housing Act was when nationally we began to recognize that discrimination in housing should be outlawed. And so we passed the 1968 Fair Housing Act.
So that's 1968. Problem solved, right?
No, not really.
No, wait a minute. 1968, nope. You can't do it anymore. It's over.
Well, by 1968, the problem is most of our metropolitan areas have already been designed, developed, planned in a segregated and divided way. And so overturning the spatial imprint of segregation is incredibly difficult to do with one law that says we're going to open up opportunity and we're going to get rid of discrimination.
Well, tell me how that works. Now, why not? Because now once it's legal, why can't I'm going to go wherever I want. I can move my family into that neighborhood that had previously been off limits.
Theoretically. So there can be discrimination against individual homeowners and also real estate agents who steer groups, blacks, into other neighborhoods. They don't even show them all of the neighborhoods that are possible, right? And then there needs to be government enforcement of fair housing. And we just don't have good government enforcing of fair housing laws.
And then redlining, again, bank policies, which are tied to federal policy going all the way back to the 30s, that prohibited loans made to minority families.
Right? That's right. We created over 200 of these residential security maps, redlining maps is what they're called. And that basically said that investing in these red-lined areas would be risky and hazardous. And these areas were primarily African-American neighborhoods. So banks didn't invest in them. You couldn't get mortgage insurance. You couldn't get home insurance in these neighborhoods that were redlined. And so lots of different disinvestment, including the public sector, disinvested in these areas.
And then that affects migration out of the city afterward once these rules change. So again, let's talk more about the legacy impact, not the historic impact, but why we're still feeling it today.
Sure. So because of redlining and because of disinvestment in cities and all of these patterns in the mid-century, including the FHA and VA opening up these low interest mortgage for mortgages for whites. Whites moved out of the city into the suburbs, and the suburbs were not opened up to African Americans. And so you have this outmigration of whites moving into the suburbs and blacks staying in the city, and this disinvestment and this unequal spatial distribution, both racially as well as investment-wise, in terms of local governments investing in these different places.
And obviously that has long-lasting effects once things begin to deteriorate. So talk about the multimedia exhibit now and the ways in which you portray these issues.
Sure. So the multimedia exhibit is an immersive experience. There are different zones that you can go into, and you can experience different facets of a divided world. For example, we have a 7-screen digital immersive display created by Google, underlaid with Google Earth. So you, when individuals that we've interviewed are talking about their neighborhoods, like I wanted to live in Creve-Coeur, then we can take you into Creve-Coeur and you can see what that neighborhood looks like. And so the user gets to experience these interviews and these experiences that when people talk about these neighborhoods. We have another zone where people who are seeking subsidized housing, assisted housing, and they receive a housing voucher, and they think that they've won the lottery. And so they go and try to find affordable rental housing in the private market. And barrier after barrier and hurdle after hurdle comes up, and it's very difficult for them to actually find the housing in the 90-day time frame that they're supposed to find housing. And so we have 6 of these different zones, so you can better understand and experience how difficult it is to have housing precarity, to be homeless, to be working poor even, and trying to find affordable housing.
Yeah, and I think these vouchers, it's a fascinating problem because, fascinating for me because I don't experience it. It's a miserable problem if you're having to experience this. The money's available. The program is there, though it's been shrinking and shrinking over the past decades. It's down to nearly nothing, but there are still vouchers available. But because of the lack of affordable housing, landlords are in a much better position to turn these away because they can get a better price some other place. And so many of these vouchers go unused.
That's right.
Even though the money's available, even though the program has shrunk, they actually go unused because landlords are in a much better place and they don't have to accept it.
Then they don't have to accept it. That is the number one biggest barrier, is that private landlords don't have to accept Section 8. However, cities are changing that. They are saying that you cannot discriminate by source of income, which means a voucher. So you can't discriminate somebody. So that's slowly changing, but right. In general, it's very difficult to find affordable housing.
So this really does come down to policy questions. It was policy that got us into this problem, and it's only policy that's going to get us out. We're going to talk more about that. But we're also talking about artistic renditions, renderings of this, rather than the statistics, to use human voices and to use visuals as a way to immerse us in this. And we have another representation coming up that's about to take the stage. I talked about Maggie West, who is the co-founder and former co-director of the Community Empowerment Fund. And she's with us now. Maggie, tell us about the Community Empowerment Fund, first of all, and what that does.
Sure. CEF works with people who are either homeless or at risk of experiencing homelessness and supports folks through relationship-based support and really whatever they need through volunteer advocates who work with them to do everything from get a photo ID to find a job to negotiate with a landlord to convince them to accept their housing choice voucher. Or to work on reaching their financial goals, but really a wide range
And so what kind of barriers do people come up against when they're trying to find, and give us this, maybe at first a sense of the scope, the people who are underhoused or who have no homes at all?
Sure. I'm not sure I can actually speak to the full scope. I can tell you that CEF works with over 1,000 members on an annual basis in both Orange and Durham counties. And from working one-on-one with members, the barriers range from folks not accepting their housing choice voucher as if it were monopoly money when it is actual money, even if the price is affordable, but discriminating based on just the fact that they are a voucher holder. Another source of discrimination is around folks that do have criminal convictions, which, given the racialized way our policing and criminal justice systems have operated for so many decades and centuries, that has become a stand-in for racial discrimination in many ways, to discriminate based on folks' criminal histories. People are discriminated against in Chapel Hill because they're not students, just landlords who are really seeking student renters. And then folks are discriminated against based on their credit histories in some cases.
Again, which can be highly racialized.
Exactly, very racialized. Yeah, yeah. So all this sort of stacks on the legacy of discrimination in our housing system.
You talk about the Community Empowerment Fund, which is kind of like a field hospital in a way. It doesn't stop the war at all. It doesn't get involved in the diplomacy that would end the madness, but it does help those who are shot up and come to your tent.
It's a bit of both. So I actually transitioned out of my role at CEF about a year ago, but I can speak a bit to the systems level work they do as well. But CEF is working one-on-one with folks, but then also trying to advocate on a local level for policies to change to fix systemic issues. So advocating around the discrimination folks face in having landlords accept their housing vouchers, advocating around there needing to be more government support for the development of affordable housing given the affordable housing crisis that we're experiencing in our communities. So a bit of both and sort of marrying those worlds.
And then drama. You get about 30 seconds because we're going to come back and talk more about affordable housing, ! The musical.
Yes.
Give us a brief preview.
Sure. So all of that advocacy work and all of those experiences with folks one-on-one led to this idea to create a musical that focused on the issue of affordable housing here locally and really dramatized the experience of the political theater here locally around affordable housing and what it's like as someone who is experiencing homelessness to go to a local government meeting, share your story, and have it not have the impact on folks that you were looking for it to have. So have it consistently be responded to by our local governments, but not necessarily responded to at the level of urgency and the pace of change that our communities are feeling is needed.
We will bring you more of a preview of Affordable Housing, the musical, and the state of things, and we'll go out on one of the songs from that musical and come back, and you'll hear much, much more. Stay with us.
I came to this bench to rest my head, and this bench, it became.
This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Well, after 15 months of preparation, the curtain will finally rise for Affordable Housing, the musical. Community Production directs the spotlight to people living without a home in Chapel Hill. The original lyrics illustrate the many ways that someone might find themselves without a home in the college town. The musical goes up this weekend, but is already sold out. We've got links to it at our website, of course. But still with us is the producer of the musical, Maggie West, and city and regional planning scholar, Mai Nguyen. Joining the conversation now is George Barrett, the choreographer for Affordable Housing, the musical, and the associate director for the Marion Cheek Jackson Center. George, welcome to you. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
Also with us, we went out on a song from vocalist Cynthia Bethay and music director Christian Fushi Green. And thank you both for the song, and thank you both for being here. Good to have you here as well.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. And also, we've got other members of this cast here, too. Artis Swan is with us.
Oh, yeah.
Artist Juan is with us. Thank you for being here. So, Maggie, I do want to ask you one more question, if I can ask you to duck in there, because I want to hear about the development, whatever, Mike, you had all arranged for. We got choreographers, actually, to get this show together, which is kind of cool. So Maggie's going to be on Mike 4. Tell me more about the development, the idea that this, how did this all come up, idea of a musical?
Definitely. It came up in a Orange County Board of Commissioners meeting originally, as we were advocating for the affordable housing bond in Orange County, and we were advocating for a $10 million bond alongside the school system, which was advocating for a $125 million bond. Big difference. and the bond was underfunded, and it was still a push to get $5 million bond from Orange County. And we had 20 people there at that meeting who were either homeless or formerly homeless, sharing their stories, and who left just devastated. And I think experiencing that difficulty of getting the connection to happen from the commissioners who are elected to serve these folks, and the 3 minutes at the microphone to share your story in a way that folks can really connect. And that disconnect inspired this idea to turn that into a bigger artistic rendition. And that kept happening with, you know, Chapel Hill town council meetings around public land, around Chapel Hill's housing bond. So seeing that just repeat, 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 and wanting to have a way to emphasize the urgency and the need for a faster pace of change, and doing that through theater.
Well, I'm glad you did. Chinita, you're part of this production, and really the musical is a product in so many ways of the stories that you and others have told. And maybe I can begin by asking you to tell us your story and how it becomes part of this musical.
Exactly. My story as a resident in Chapel Hill for 6 years, I'd been in the education system teaching, and I'd been living in the same place for 6 years. And all of a sudden, at the lease renewal time, I was made aware of a new policy that would take my rent from $685 for a two-bedroom and with a 30-day notice to $2,110 a month.
Hold it.
Exactly.
$685 to
$2,110, three times the amount.
In 30 days.
In 30 days. So that was my struggle of trying to find what resources of affordable housing that I had at that time.
What'd you do?
Well, I started going to different hotels. It was my first choice. I thought, let me find something quick, and went to three or four different hotels and wanted to get a place to stay until I could find affordable housing. And I found out another policy that existed. Each person asked me for my ID, and in giving them and presenting my ID, they informed me that in Chapel Hill, if your address is not 50 miles outside the city, you can't get a place here. Exactly. So no room in the inn, not even with money in your pocket.
All right, I want to hear more about this story, but I'd also like to hear a little bit of the musical as well, a little bit more. So maybe what we'll do is I'll ask you to do a song for us now, and then we'll come back and we'll talk some more. All right?
This is a piece from our affordable musical, and it's titled Hurricane Matthew. Sitting at the wheel but not to drive, with nowhere to go, there's nowhere to ride. Set in the woods, this Jeep's become my tent, denied housing again despite money for rent. Hurricane Matthew is on its way. Get to shelter, find a place to stay. I taught students in town for over 10 years, but they'd never imagine me sitting in fear. We hide these storms from the kids at school, but to not share my experience seems so cruel. Hurricane Matthew is on its way. Get to shelter, find a place to stay. Back then, I had a home, a place with a price I could pay, but the price went up and my home went away. Looking at apartments, turned away again. Why don't they choose me? Is it the color of my skin? Hurricane Matthew is on its way. Get to shelter, find a place to stay. Three times the income, harder to stay, but not for students whose parents pay. Where is the justice in this today? Where is the justice in this, I say? The storm is real, but is it really worse than the storms falling me like a bitter curse? Matthew's passed, but I still feel the pain. My search for housing is still thunder and pain.
Janita Howard performing Hurricane Matthew is on its way from Affordable Housing, the musical. You also heard Christian Fushi Green on the keyboard and initially before that spoken word piece. The Affordable Housing, the musical is actually sold out, but there is a link to the soundtrack and you can pre-order that. And that's at our website, stateofthings.org. You talked about your students not being able to experience this. You were working this whole time. Where were you working?
I was working at that particular time at Smith Middle School in Chapel Hill. And so each day there was an experience to have to go to school and come home, and home was in my Jeep. And you still have to get up every day. And thanks to a lot of the local business folks who allowed me to come in and prep in the morning, and the Wendy's manager would let you fill your cooler up. So living in the Jeep in the woods during a hurricane was probably one of the most frightening experiences that I have ever experienced. And to be homeless for the first time was an exposure that I will never forget. So it's really added to the part of wanting to advocate for those who are also trying to find affordable housing.
I mean, not only the vulnerability that you just described, but I would also think maybe some of the anxiety about, I mean, did you feel that you had to hide this from your students? Did you let them know? Is that any part of the pressure?
Well, not only your students, but it gives a state of homelessness, gives a state of mind that with a degree, you know, and money in your pocket, it's hard for you not to say, how did I get here? How did this happen? And you wonder, you sometimes take it personal, but you feel like that there's other factors that play into where, you know, the policies need to be made or need to be changed that would adhere to everyone being able to afford a place to live. So you don't want to share it with family or friends, you know, that when I leave school today, I'm going to back up and get in this Jeep and I will call it a night and my alarm will be set and I have my charger. And so that was for 3 months.
How much of this were you blaming? It sounds like part of this was sort of blaming yourself or trying to figure out a way that you might have been at fault for some of this.
Well, I think the fault part was when you think that you've gone to school and you've done all the right things and you've gone to college and you've gotten your degree, that how would I miss something? But I think that adds to the part of individuals being involved and what our communities and what our officials are doing in policies. It really pushes the reason why it's important to stay in touch with our local leaders and what policies they're making and the ways that they can affect all of us.
We're talking about Affordable Housing, the musical, on stage this weekend and in Chapel Hill. I'm talking to Janita Howard, who is one of the participants and one of the authors of some of the material and creators of co-creators of the material. Maggie West, let's talk about this next piece, if I can, because I know that the piece we're going to hear accompanies a scene about living in a shelter. Maybe I can help you ask you to talk about the piece, but it's also a little bit about the process by which this came together, right? Yeah, sure. George, do we want to take that one?
Yeah. So, I mean, with a lot of this process, a lot of it, especially the movement, but also the things that connected into the piece, as you already heard, came from people's personal stories. So this next song you hear, Something's Gotta Give, actually how it kind of formulated is it first started when we were doing improv exercises, like improv acting exercises. And in that, I remember artists kept saying, something's got to give. And then that held. And then at a next rehearsal, he started playing the piano, which we didn't know at the time. And it was just this beautiful melody, but it was coming from his experiences and it was coming from what these true lives experiences. And so at being present to that moment, we started, as artists is playing, to do gesture work. And so the cast created gestures based on, okay, when you think of Something's Got to Give, what is a gesture that comes to mind? And then we kind of, as a group, formulated how do these gestures fit together? And I kind of played more the role of like choreography consultant, you could say, of like putting the puzzle pieces together. And then, but it's all, again, all coming from artists' story. And so that then created the steps, you could say. And then artists wrote the lyrics of the song. Christian put music to it, created the full song. And then we came back, put the phrase and some acting things together to create this Something's Gotta Give scene.
All right. Can we hear it now?
Yeah.
Ooh, 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 I've been searching all over, trying to find a place to stay. Seems like nothing will ever come my way. Trying to hold on. Sometimes I feel like giving up. When I got to get to my lowest point, this what I gotta do. I said
something has got to give.
Wait a minute. My credit score is going down. Seems like life is getting me down. I can't get no help. Nobody seems to care. Can't pin on my friends to help me through. All I know, this is what I gotta do, because
something has got to give.
I'm out there homeless.
I've been fighting out here.
Can't take it no more.
doing the best I can.
Get down to my lowest point.
Does anybody care? What about me?
What about me? Anybody out there? Anybody out there cares? Yeah.
Something has got to give from the musical Affordable Housing, sold out this weekend on vocals artist Swan and Cynthia Bethay. Christian Fushi Green was playing the keyboard on that. We also spoke with Maggie West and George Barrett, who is the associate director and choreographer for this particular show. Mind Nguyen was with us as well, a professor of public studies and regional planning at UNC Chapel Hill. I want to thank all of you for being on the program. And maybe what I could ask you to do is just in the last few seconds, if you reprise just the end of that song while I say, this is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.
I came to this bench to rest my head, and this bench, it became my bed. I'm out here all alone. This bench is the only one I can rely on until I get myself together. Until I get myself together again. So now if this bench belongs to anyone, it belongs to me. Winter time, summertime, the only place I gotta be. Every night I take off my shoes for just that one moment. I'm free, hoping nobody bothers me. The sun says close after dark, but you never know around this park. I can't do much sleeping. Don't know where evil's creeping. I wake up ready to drive. Bad.